Welcome, listeners, to Season 7, our new season in this year. Before we begin, of course, we must not forget that we are living and working in Xikrepikulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Skrepmuk people. It's obvious that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, today we have the great pleasure of welcoming Sonia Rokosh to join us on Food Conversations. Sonia is a community animator with Farm to School BC, a program under the aegis of the Public Health Association of BC. Now, that's about as dry an introduction as you could possibly imagine, but you will soon find out that Sonia is the opposite of dry. She's enthusiastic, articulate, and deeply motivated as a representative of a new way of looking at food. Food as a key to community and personal empowerment, and as Sonia said to me before we came on air, a powerful means to save the rainforest. Welcome, Sonia, to Food Conversations.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me today. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, absolutely. Hear you okay? See you on Zoom. And for our listeners, due to weather circumstances, traveling it was not an option to come from Kamloops. So we're delighted to have Sonia in the studio on our Zoom screen, and her smiling face is visible. And if only the listeners could see her lovely smile, you'd be enjoying every moment. We're going to talk about the special meaning for you, Sonia, of the phrase saving the rainforest later in the show. But I think the first order of business is to explore the meaning of your official role. Now, the title community animator isn't familiar to everyone listening to this show. And so I looked up a definition. What is the internet useful for anyway, if you can't do that sort of thing? And I found one from the report of the European Cultural Foundation, which was written a half century ago in 1973, and which goes like this. First, they talk about what community animation is all about. Animation is that stimulus to the mental, physical, and emotional life of people in any given area, which moves them to undertake a wider range of experiences through which they find a higher degree of self-realization, self-expression, and awareness of belonging to a community which they can influence. And then animators, and that's you, Sonia, place local people at the center of all they do. The word is suggestive of being active and positive, of enthusing, working with, not for, folk, of bringing out the best, of motivating and inspiring, helpfully, not suggestive of any hierarchical relationship between the worker and the community. Now, Sonia, you could rest while I was reading that, because that's a pretty tall order for anyone. So let's look at some specifics. Let's look at the word stimulus. Stimulus is, you know, it's a word that's used in neurological science and all this sort of thing. But what for a community animator is the kind of stimulus that you adopt to move people to undertake a wider range of experiences and find self-realization and self-expression? So go, Sonia, tell us why.
Ooh, okay.
Well, you can pick yourself up off the floor after all.
Okay,
that.
I'm gonna take a moment. Yeah, I know. I'm gonna take a moment to breathe and settle in.
Yeah.
So let me just start by introducing myself and where I am. So my name is Sonia Rokosh. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm calling in today from Tkamloops, also part of Xikrepikulu Ulu. I feel humbled to live here and constantly try to unlearn and relearn my relationship with this land.
It's an ongoing process.
So that was a big definition, Warren. Thanks for looking that up. I don't think I could have articulated that this morning at 9:08 a.m.
Well, it's interesting because somebody was on the notes you sent me. Yeah. You'd actually unwittingly copied half of it in your notes. Yeah. It must have got around. It must have gone around. Anyway,
okay.
So why don't you say just say what you do, Sonia, just to heck with everything else. Just say how you do your work.
Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. But thanks for mentioning that animation and being an animator is not something that we throw around as a term. I think sometimes community development work is often a phrase we hear more often, but some might think animation means graphic or something to do with digital technology. And I will just say, I like to self-identify as a Luddite. So that is not like the way that I see my strengths aligning with this role. So I would say a community animator, to use a bit of a symbolic image, is similar to a bumblebee or another native pollinator we might have here. I see myself as an egg force that wants to be connecting these larger assets and bodies of knowledge or bodies of enthusiasm with the places that perhaps haven't had access to them or are thirsty for them. So I suppose I am a networker. I act like a very high energy mycelium system, but I also take quite a slow approach. That's something I've learned in this role over time is, as you were mentioning, people are at the center of all of this, and that's my community and the community you live in, community I live in. And I'm trying to see community projects as assets that we already have here in the community. We take an asset-based community development approach to all of our intentional time and the output that I give. So I'm a connector, Warren, in a sense. I'm a connector. Sure. I bring energy places. I help empower folks. I also help make dreams reality, I suppose. Well, I guess I might be stroking my ego there. Maybe I don't make dreams a reality, but what I'd like to I'd like to let people know. I like to let people know that some supports and the resources are right there. They just might not know they're there yet, whether that's financial support, volunteer support.
So why don't you talk a little bit about the assets that you avail yourself of and you encourage others to avail themselves of, because that's a key to what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, in one sense, at Farm to School BC, are an asset that we can offer financial one. So we offer grants. We have a grants process. We accept applications in the fall, and we can offer $1,000 or $3,000 project-based grants. So those are eligible to anybody who's working with youth in kindergarten to grade 12. That's sometimes all it takes to get a project in motion, is that little bit of support right there at the beginning.
So this is seed money.
Seed money.
And goes to somebody who's working with students?
Yes. So in my role as community animator with Farm to School BC, all of our projects are engaged with students in K to 12. That doesn't always have to look like project only run by a teacher. It can be a project that has many partners involved with it. There just always must be a classroom and a classroom champion being part of that application process. And I think, like you probably know yourself, all sustainable projects take a family or a team to keep them afloat, especially in our small communities here in Interior BC.
Let's talk about a phrase you used when you were sending us sort of background information, and it was the phrase student food literacy. What does that concept embody? Because I think it's a key concept in what you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Warren, for bringing that up. I think that food literacy is a term that looks at a student, a person, an individual, anybody, understanding the impact this have on our collective health, our individual health, the health of our environment, and also our economy. And it's understanding, in addition to that, not just the principle, but knowing that all of these different components and impacts are not experienced like equitably by everyone. So it really is, it can be a really deep dive. You can take that comprehension as layered as you'd like to. What I like about the term food literacy is it implies that we can have a spectrum of literacy. There can be, I am more literate in this area than another, and it can always grow and develop and expand.
Just to remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Sonia Rokosh, who is a community animator with the Farm to School BC program, which is under the management of the Public Health Association of BC. So let's pick another phrase, which I also think is central to what you do. And you use the phrase school and community connectedness. And that seems to me to be a fundamental principle of your sort of day-to-day work. Why don't you talk about how that comes into being, how you make that happen, that connectedness?
Well, it takes time. I am grateful that this region here in Kamloops has been in existence since 2014. The Kamloops Regional Hub. I will say the Kamloops Regional Hub expanded into School District 83 just within the past 3.5 years. That's a new partnership. But I think when an animator is chosen for their position, there's a lot of reflection on their history in the community as their current job or their positionality within the greater society and organizations that I already hold connections with. So for myself, I am a teacher. That's my certification. That's part of my vocation. And that was quite helpful in having those relationships already established. I also was working at the outdoor school in Samnarm for a few years, and I found the friendships and the community that I was exposed to was at the heart of making those relationships here in Samnarm. And then that led to expanding into the food systems work that happens in Samnarm and just being able to witness the passion that's there. It was quite easy, to be honest. Felt like I was jumping onto a raft on a fast flowing river as soon as I started to learn, like, Shishwat Food Action. Okay. Serena Kainer. Oh, okay. Melanie Bennett. Oh, right. Talking to these people. And then it was like, I was riding it.
You were swept away. You were swept away. Good title for a movie. Now, let's sort of change gears a little bit, because like most people who come on Food Conversations, in fact, to be honest, like most people, period, life began for you in very different circumstances, and you were born in BC, but at the age of the ripe old age of 2, you and your family moved to Peru because your father had been offered a job in the mining industry in Peru. He took the job. It was supposed to be a 2-year thing, but he renewed the contract repeatedly, and so it ended up being an 11-year stint in a culture that has many different aspects from our own, and a culture where there's different sets of values, sometimes from the values that we espouse. You actually lived in a company compound, which was embedded in the larger Peruvian community. So there were kind of these two worlds face to face. What do you remember about the sort of gist of this dichotomous world that you lived in? There was the compound, and then there was the wider community.
Yeah, I should just share with people listening and with you, like, this brings up like quite an emotional response. It's to be honest, I don't tend to disclose my background to many people in the world that I work in. Sometimes I feel like some shame that has taken some time to mature into understanding and into reflective process.
So I'm going to add a note here that will maybe help you in that. There's a little town next to ours called Falkland, and it's named after a relative of mine who was a colonel in the Royal Artillery, whose career as a military officer included going to India and firing off his artillery at the Indian communities that the colonial power, Britain, was intending to exploit for its own purposes. So if we could have a shaming contest, and I might win. So I hope you won't feel... And why I think that's important is because we all have some history that is part of what used to be and is not part of what is now. And so I think that background you have is a huge asset, because you know what you're talking about. You know what this dichotomy really is and how we have to make transformational changes. I mean, not just little changes, but big changes. Mm-hmm. So there's these two worlds that you're faced with, but, you know, your family is your family and they love you. And then you go out in the community, you meet people who have different, very different worlds. And you specifically went to markets because your dad had some health problems and your mother decided to get the local food, the fresh, healthy food. So what's it like going to these markets with vendors, learning Spanish, flawless Spanish, because that's what we do when we're young. What was that like?
Sí, por supuesto. Por supuesto. Thanks. No, it's true. I think you're painting a really real picture of what it's like. There was a gated community I lived in for it was liability purposes, so that the expats were kept contained, protected, whatever one wants to say in response to that. But as you mentioned, my dad, when he was in his 20s, we found out that he had quite a few allergies to sugar, to refined sugar. So my mom, like you mentioned, would take it upon herself to create everything from scratch. And that included having to source fruits to fulfill his sweet tooth. or sweet potatoes. Peru has over 300 varieties of potatoes. And we soon discovered the happy accident that sometimes over half of them are sweet potato varieties. So we would go into an open air. The setting is one where there's like a concrete foundation poured and there's a couple probably tin or aluminum shacks over top of these market spaces, and you're walking through them and you're seeing families. You're seeing the whole family come to this market because now as I'm older, I understand like that is both the excursion of the week, but also their livelihood. And one would understand that the youth in these families are learning this experience. And I suppose this training at such a young age, because they're helping in the fields, they're helping grow this food, they're understanding charm and how to charm different buyers into buying their products, to be honest, being charismatic, having a story, really draws in a consumer and draws in a human to connect with another human.
It's almost like I mean, as you're describing this, I can see the nascent community animator getting field training. You know, it's like field training. It's learning about connecting to people. It's learning, and especially also with food being a therapy. You're seeing food as a source of health, as in addition to just a source of calories. It's a source of good calories that you can ingest safely, as opposed to the kind of refined stuff that is very popular in our part of the world, which we now are realizing wasn't such a good idea. So you first of all, you learned Spanish. Second of all, you had, I think you told me you had more Peruvian friends in total than you had friends from within the gated community. And so you were seeing a world that clearly has, I mean, looking at what you're doing today, it's really shaped the direction you've moved in and given you exceptional insights that not everybody has. You told me when I asked you what was the sort of main thing that was in your mind, that you said, and that's where the saving the rainforest notion came up. And of course, your father's work was heading in quite a different direction. But on the other hand, to me, it seems like a beautiful metaphor for everything that we all must do. I mean, there's a rainforest wherever you live. It might be a desert rainforest, but it's a natural system upon which we are completely dependent. And you, at this very early age, had this motivation. I think it's a beautiful thing. So I'll stop saying that for a bit, and we can get back to talking about what happened. So You saw the life of privilege that you were living. You saw what was face to face. You were seeing this clash of cultures. But then when you were 13, you came back to Canada, the land where this different community is located. What was it like coming back from being immersed in this essentially Hispanic, small scale community and to the big city, as it were?
It was culture shock. It was complete culture shock. We would come as a family. We were able to afford coming home to Canada once a year. So we would come in the summers. My dad would have some holidays. We would visit their families in the East Kootenays and in Prince George. And it was always, it was like going to Disneyland, to be honest. It was surreal. Not only could you go to the gas station and find 5 cent candies. Like I have this memory of being like so overwhelmed with this place where people gas up and you have these candies available to you. Or also to be honest, going into a grocery store and being confused as to how I'm accessing such varieties of fruit and vegetables. And those memories probably aren't as front of mind like for me, because as a kid my priorities are 5 cent candies and Black Forest ham on buns, because that was also a novel experience.
Because you could have the refined sugar and survive.
Yeah, absolutely. Teenage metabolism there. But I can't imagine what that would have been like to reflect back at that age. Like I don't know what my life would have looked like if it was different and I grew up in Canada. But I think to be honest, from even as a teenager, it made me experience awe and wonder so much more greatly in these circumstances of engagement with nature, engagement with food, meeting people who produce food. And it made me reflect on the fact that not everyone has had this exposure. And that may sound obvious hearing this narrative that I'm describing, which comes of a place of privilege, multiple layers of privilege, one can say, but it also is my reality. Yes. And my reality is that as a teenager coming back to North America, I realized people don't know their farmers. People don't know the folks who are helping build that tight-knit community of food producers.
So you saw up close and personal, as they say, what people's lives are like when they're part of a closely knit community, and where food in particular is an essential element in the social matrix in which they live. Now, I'm going to remind listeners once again, since we're talking about social matrices and things like that, that I'm speaking with Sonia Rokosch, who is a community animator with Farm to School BC. And that's a program under the management of the Public Health Association of BC. So here you are, you're back in Canada. You've gone to school, presumably for a number of years in Canada, in the sort of the high school environment. And then the opportunity after school to go further in your education comes up. And not surprisingly, the first degree that you sought at UVic was a Bachelor of Environmental Studies. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more. So you've gone from being immersed in a culture where relationships and families and food are all sort of intermingled in this very direct way. And here you are at university studying environmental studies. Now, what was that like going from the world of daily life, food and the environment in a sort of a daily life, to this intellectual exploration? How did that feel for you?
I felt driven and I felt humbled by the teachers that I was exposed to. I had the privilege, one of my first teachers in environmental studies was the ethnobotanist Nancy Turner, a very well-known
who has a strong connection to Salmon Arm and to the Shkreplak people and to Mary Thomas. Mm-hmm. They were very good friends. Well, that's a wonderful connection. Mm-hmm. It sort of cemented the link to this part of the world.
And I then found out Nancy was teaching her last first year environmental studies class. And this was a figure who showed up in my life in a time where I was, for lack of better words, feeling disjointed, a little bit disconnected, and not really knowing what my place in this new space of UVic would be like. And I think I would like to offer a huge gratitude to that serendipitous circumstance that happened. And then in that same class, Warren, I'll tell you, I was exposed to a small nonprofit called Moskoi, which worked to revitalize traditional textile practices in the Sacred Valley of Peru. So after three classes in Intro to Environmental Studies, ES200, within those first three classes, I was volunteering for a nonprofit based out of Peru that revitalized traditional weaving practices and used natural dyes and in all of their work. And then so smitten by Nancy Turner. So that's gonna paint the picture of, I suppose, this yellow brick road of how I could be engaged in my both student social and student academic life at UVic.
It was almost like the universe was sort of handing these little serendipitous nudges to move you along. Now, the interesting thing is you did a double major, and the other half of the major wasn't so entrancing. It was Spanish or Hispanic studies, and it turned out to be very intellectual. What was that like as a counterpoint to what you were, this lively, enlivening experience you were having in environmental studies?
I'm chuckling here on the other side because I'm thinking of one of my
former professors. Yes, dear listeners, I can see Sonia chuckling.
So I actually, to give you some context, I ran into one of my professors from Hispanic Studies 2 years ago at a naturalist program in Clearwater, of all places, called Deer Trails. And he was out of his comfort zone. And he comes up to me, he goes, "Sonia?" It's like Spanish Sonia.
Yes.
And I look and I was like, "Oh, Professor Dan, ¿qué haces aquí? What are you doing here?"
Yeah.
And it was this complete mind warp, because it took me back to that time when I took Hispanic Studies as my second major. And I went into it naive, thinking that I would rock those courses because I was fluent in Spanish, to find out I hadn't read the schedule or the course outlines. And quickly understood I had signed up for an intense literature program.
It was
looking at Pablo Neruda and Gabriel Garcia Marquez and
the impact of magic realism on daily life. Oh, Lord.
Absolutely. And those expressions of art and creativity and pain and suffering and love are all so important. And I think that art, artistic outlet is just another beauty of the human experience.
Of course.
That is not for me. I am not a writer. Those who know me will know it's odd that I'm a teacher, but it is appropriate. I only teach up to grade 3 or 5, probably, because my writing skills are challenged often. Anyway, sorry, little side note.
No, but that's an illustration of how, I mean, the lessons we learn are sometimes negative lessons. Like, that's not where I'm going, because it just doesn't work for me. And also it can be just irrelevant in what you know you can do that you can have an impact about. Now, you also, after you got that bachelor's degree, you moved on to a diploma in restoration of natural systems. And that ended up being centered around a project that tied this kind of conflicted nexus together, because it was a mining reclamation project in the Panama. And there you saw up front this kind of this struggle that the world is going through right now, which is the struggle between extractivism or capitalism on the one hand, and yet the ecosystem on which we depend crying out for, in this case, you know, please put some elements back together so that this ecosystem can function again. What was that like, being in the company of biologists who were also tied to industry, whether they, you know, thought about it all the time or not? What was that like?
Yeah, I think everyone listening can relate to this experience, this dichotomy of being a active citizen in the society and economy that we live in, yet also battling these internal moral dilemmas. And it became more apparent to me in Panama, because the folks who I was working with during that reclamation project were so intelligent and skilled and very politically savvy. They knew what was going on, and they were also grateful to have a job that paid quite well in relation to other jobs with their educational background in Panama. So it's a place where I think sometimes we as humans do this balancing act, maybe every day, if not at every junction in our lives, where we have to see what outweighs the other. And for some people, it's putting food on the table for dinner. And that's going to mean following a path that offers you comfort and offers you familiarity.
And so many people have not, in this part of the world, have not had even remotely experiences like what we're talking about right now, to see these two worlds in sort of conflict, but also to see people trying to navigate that. What a perspective that you can bring back to this part of the world, this perspective of how on the ground issues are addressed.
Yeah, what I really appreciate about my global childhood is that it is constantly apparent that we're all human and we have these same struggles. So like you're saying, I suppose I've seen some extreme examples, but I also think the feelings that come up when I am exposed to them are the exact same. It's a feeling of conflict, a feeling both of gratitude and perhaps shame.
I thought I was trying to out-compete you with the shame department.
Oh, shame.
Yes. Now, it whatever you might have felt and ambivalence you might have had and, you know, sort of inner conflicts, you nevertheless soldiered on, which is a bad metaphor, by the way. But
maybe appropriate for the background here.
Well, sometimes you have to just push on through what appear to be difficult circumstances. But you went back to university and did a diploma in this restoration. But after that, you went and got your horticultural certification at Thompson Rivers University. And then you expanded that even further by going into formal teacher training at TRU, and you graduated in 2019. So to me, what that says is that you were working on this dilemma sort of all the time, because it's part of your life, but the path you chose was definitely a path in tune with the circumstances of the 21st century. So horticultural certification, that's certification, but what do you get certified for? We sometimes get certified for the wrong reason, but I think this was good certification.
So this is so funny. As you're exposing everyone to my educational background, I'm adding up the debt that I have, and I hope listeners are also adding up the debt I have. And and we're not even finished through that list.
So if there are any donations, donors out there, go for it. Anyway.
Oh, no. So the horticulture certification, the truth of that is I was at a point in my life where I was moving from Vancouver, and I had a path set out where I was going to buy a house with my partner at the time in Kamloops, who loved Kamloops and had been there before, and actually we ended up splitting our future destiny at that time. We broke up. And so I had already...
That's a very eloquent way of describing it. You should be a writer.
So what happened was I had already actually applied to the horticulture department. And the funny piece there is my mom had taken that same certification when she and my dad lived in Kamloops for a very short period of time before I was born. So I think there was this like nostalgic piece where I was trying to perhaps connect to parts of my mom, parts of like my maternal lineage. And I love plants, and I'm a plant geek, but I'm not a botanist. And I self-identify as a nerdy naturalist. But I like to grow things. I like to get down on the ground and identify things with my field books, but I suppose I thought the horticulture certification would be a way to come into that field.
By the way, dear listeners, a feline climbed on the shoulder Thomas' right shoulder. I hope you let her participate in the interview because I'm sure she has some important things to add.
Yes, that's Alice. Actually, they use they, them pronouns, and they're from Manitoba. It's my rescue kitty. So sorry, back to horticulture. I was a little bit disenchanted with the reality that horticulture, the way it was taught through Thompson Rivers, had a focus on grass, lawns, golf courses.
Are you serious? And, my goodness gracious! I'm feeling a little queasy.
that wasn't all of it. That was a larger component than I had originally thought would exist in the program. And I made some great contacts, and I have still a friendship with one of my instructors there, who I lean on for horticultural wisdom, but. I think it's one of those pieces, again, Warren, where you mentioned with the Hispanic studies, it was not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to go into landscaping because the world we are in here, at least in Kamloops, is at a place where they're trying to change direction to more native plants and xeriscaping, but we're still using lawns a lot. Well, a different conversation.
No, but it is part, again, of the ambivalence that all of us are feeling. The Shuswap Climate Action Society, which runs in parallel with the Shuswap Food Action Society, one of their programs is ditch the lawn. In other words, there's lots of other things you can do with land besides planting grass and cutting it very short and making it all homogeneous and monocultural. Now, the next step you took, which was to go into teacher training, was clearly... It seems to me, compared to the other stuff, you were learning material about, you know, the world that we live in and how we make it a better place. But in teaching, you're learning skills that are skills and connections and qualifications that give you an entree into sharing the knowledge that you have and to aliving people who are coming to you to learn about it, too.
I feel like we're being so honest here. So I will be even as transparent as I can be. Education was appealing to me, the program, because I had puttered through life for so long feeling financially insecure. And that was one of the biggest draws to me. I hear exactly what you're saying. And now that nurtures my heart when I engage with youth. But I also realized that I think I needed some job security. So I went into this.
Again, I'm going to try and allay your fears, because when I went into medicine with a previous degree in music and creative writing, I could see a life of penury and indigence. And I said, well... it was actually a result of an aptitude and interest test that said that was something I was suited for. But we're in the true confessions tradition. I can tell you that it's something that probably everybody thinks about at some point. You know, you get to the point where you say it's all very well to, you know, fly in the clouds and, you know, experience, you know, touch the hand of God. But what about food on the table tomorrow? Everybody, I think, needs it. Now, I just want to remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Sonia Rokosh, who's the community animator for Farm to School BC, which is part of the programming of the Public Health Association of BC. I think it's probably true that what you did was a pragmatic move, but it was also a move that allowed you to go into worlds where you could say, I'm a trained teacher. I qualify. You know, the door, the key to open the door is in my hand, and I'm turning it, and here I am. And that is something that is really very germane to what you're doing now and very much part of what we've talked about up to this point. So even though pragmatism played a big role in your choice, nevertheless, you plunged in right away to what seems to me a direct extension of everything you'd been doing before, because you worked for a couple of years in Salmon Arm at the outdoor school. Now, what could be more affiliated with your interest than working outdoors with kids that were open? I mean, you were relating to all the kids in Peru, and you knew how to do that. And for 2 years, you were in this naturalistic kind of program, as opposed to the sort of traditional line up and desk and that kind of stuff. So what did that feel like to be able to bring all these things together?
Well, I should start off offering credit where credit is due. And I will say very honestly that my decision to go into teaching was greatly influenced by two teachers there in the Salmon School District. That was Jaron Kaner and Jeff Stiles. They're both at the outdoor school right now. And really what I saw in them as mentors was their lifelong commitment to bringing that sense of connection and human relationship to youth. And I'm sure everyone knows engaging with youth can be challenging, and you don't always know what amount of what you're saying is being digested. But what I can say that experience at the outdoor school offered me was grounding small humans in spaces that feel safe and relational to both them and the community. And by that, I mean, they're out there at the parks nearby. They're out there in the forest adjacent to the school. They're noticing the changes. They're learning to advocate for pieces of spaces to be protected, because it's also their play space. It's a space that they're having to show up to every day. I think that it really brought back this connection to relationship that has clearly been a strong thread since my existence and memory in this world, whether it's to food or to people or to community. And it was so unique. I'm sure listeners know that school is still in its infancy. It's past its toddler legs into, I believe it's fourth, maybe fifth year.
And it's oversubscribed massively. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. such a draw for parents and children. I think parents see the enlivening nature of their kids, not just sitting in a row and absorbing information, but creating and engaging with the natural world around them.
Mm-hmm. And I think one piece at that school that has shown to be true is that the students who come out of that school are resilient. Mm-hmm. And we perhaps are not going to pass every test in the high 90s, and perhaps we're not going to come out as the top mathematician. But if you're nurturing and raising young people to be resilient in the face of not only a climate crisis, but in my opinion, a very confusing economic system in the year 2024. But I just think you're offering folks, for lack of better words, like a leg up to be able to adapt and to see changes and need to have response to it.
And there's an interesting corollary there with respect to the resurgence of Indigenous values and learning. And I think it's got to do with the fact that, and I'm not the only person who thinks this, of course, that it's connected deeply to the fact that when you interact in profound ways with the natural world around you, it teaches you what the natural world does, which is become resilient, which is cooperate and collaborate, which is interact constantly and wait for the next season. You know, kind of an expectation that we live in this kind of cyclic pattern of biological and meteorological activity. And when we adapt to it, we become resilient. You know, spring comes after mm-hmm. winter, and then summer mm-hmm. comes after spring, and then fall comes after summer. That kind of procession, which is why Indigenous culture has actually survived. They've outweighed all the foolishness that we visited upon, the marginalization and the other kind of impositions that we laid on them. And so here are children learning from that natural world. And of course, they're teachers who, as you said, very much talk about relationship and connection. But I want to mention also the fact that this wasn't the end of your educational activities, and you're still immersing. Yeah, you forgot about the latest degree you're seeking, which is a master's degree in environmental education and communications at Royal Roads University, which is a wonderful school where you can do things at a distance constantly. Almost all their work is that way. And as a sidebar, you worked for a while at Marionette Winery, but I'll just mention that as a sidebar because it sort of combines a whole bunch of things as well. But the master's degree in environmental education and communication seems to be another extension of the path that you're clearly on, which was shaped from such a long time ago, but is very, very powerful. And that is environmental education and communications. Tell me what the gist of that, because I have my own delighted fantasy, but I want to know what's it really like.
Yeah, I'm quite proud of myself in making the decision to pursue this. This also was...
We're moving beyond shame. We're into pride. Excellent. A good way
Thumbs
to move.
Thumbs up for pride. It's true. And I, once again, will need to plug Jaron Kaner was the person who suggested this program to me. And no, he is not getting any percentage of the money that we're funding right now for my student loan debt. But anyways.
Well, you could just say he's Serena Kaner's husband and a good guy.
Yeah, he is. Right. So I'm painting a picture. So we're having a foundation of pedagogical practices in environmental education. So we're understanding what the foundations of the development in different models of education are. And we're having possibilities to expand our learning on how to engage youth with hands-on experiences outdoors or with the more than human world, really. And it doesn't always have to be outdoors. We can bring it indoors. We can bring it into our walls if we need to. But the communications piece, I didn't really know what I was getting into. But what I found is those have been maybe the most valuable classes because I'm learning that if we can communicate between these dichotomies, if we can learn to parlay, to liaison between all of these different driving forces that we are a part of, I really do think that we can have this common ground and this connectedness that brings us together as community, whether that's shared values, whether that's shared cultural relationships, or maybe that's kids. We all want the best for kids, for the future generation. We are hoping that 7 generations from now, there will still be a beautiful planet for us to exist on.
Your final stage of the study is next month. And then you will indeed be a master of environmental education communications. And your student debt will now become... sort of circumscribed. You'll know when it ends to some degree and the dealing with it begins. But student debt is something that I am sure a great number of readers, of listeners rather, can understand very well and how it ends up shaping our lives. You know, it's that sort of Damocles hanging over our heads. Somebody's going to say, now we would like reimbursement, and you aren't going to say, well, I'm not sure I can do that. Now, another part of what we really do need to talk about, and I'm not even sure we can have time to do it today, so if you're agreeable, I would like to ask if you would come back and talk about the Kamloops scene, because you're very much embedded in what's going on in Kamloops, and there's some really astonishingly groundbreaking things that have happened in the Kamloops scene with respect to food and community building that I think deserve a show of their own. So with that teaser for listeners and the thumbs up from you, Sonia, I want to mention a couple of things. In the movie Cowspiracy, I don't know if you ever saw it, but it's a movie about, you know, how the fast food industry is doing some peculiar things that are quite destructive to especially the rainforest. And that was something that we talked, I brought it up because it was such a powerful image when you raised it. And one of the reasons that the rainforest is being compromised is to clear land for cattle so we can grow hamburgers and steaks on the hoof for consumption in this part of the world. And I wonder if you could just say a word or two about that's the situation you know so well and that you sort of almost can feel in your bones, I would guess, that that motivates you to work the way you're doing now and makes such gives you some energy, maybe some despair at times, but also some inspiration to move ahead.
And Warren, are you also wanting to know my relationships with beef, or are you just speaking to?
Oh,
happy to share.
Beef is comes from cows and cattle, and it's consumed by people over the world. And we're not so sure that we should be eating a lot of beef because there's a lot of methane that's involved, and there's a lot of land degradation. But it can be done properly on a small scale, as has been shown by various people around the world. If you do it right and you don't do it on a big scale, you can actually do it okay. But yes, you can tell me what you ate for breakfast this morning and what the listeners will say.
I think as many of us do, we ebb and flow through different activist movements, different values, different morals, different stances that draw us to a sense of who we are. And I have gone through these paths of exploring veganism, exploring different activist movements to engage with a more wholesome relationship with food. And now I've come to the place, this mantra that I feel my parents also were saying to themselves was, we're doing the best we can. And I'm doing the best I can with what I have available to me, both my financial situation and the relationships I have, the exploration of a barter system. So I myself love beef and pork, and I try to buy my pork from Fresh Valley Farms just outside of Armstrong, who are fourth generation regenerative farm, and my beef from Bunchgrass Meats. They do wild sagebrush grazing for their cattle, so they actually give them huge space. It's delicious.
You know what? I think you've just exemplified once again, in real terms, the dilemmas that all of us face. And the dilemmas are that making choices to go this way means that we have to think about another problem that we didn't take into consideration before. You've done a wonderful job of laying that out for our listeners, and I'm very grateful to have had you on the show. And I would really very much like to have you back again to talk about the Kamloops scene and what's going on there and the marvels that are happening in that world. Sonia Rokosh, community animator and very lively guest on our show, for which we are always grateful. Thank you very much for being with us today, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, Warren. My pleasure. Take care.